Just tell you what I'm going to do today. I think it's 7, I hope. So we were left last time, and so we're doing quantum gravity in 3 dimensions, introducing all the structure which are very much the same in 4 dimensions. And what I've done so far is the Hilbert space and the operators. Okay, so I have to do the transition amplitudes. So everything is depends on a graph. A graph is a set of nodes and links. If you want, this is just combinatorial. So a link, you can think just pairs of nodes. A graph is oriented. We need orientation to define things properly. In particular, the group elements are attached to direction of the link. And it's a dual of a two-dimensional triangulation, so it's a dual of something made by a lot of triangles attached to one another, so it's trivalent, meaning that each node bounds exactly 3 links. So a graph is, say, this one. For instance. Okay? So these are the nodes, these are the links, they're oriented. And out of this graph, we build a Hilbert space, which is L2 of SU2 to the number of links. So the links L here goes from 1 to L. And we have one group element U, L, associated to each link L, sort of oriented. Now, it's convenient to do things properly and easily and to have less heavy expressions to also consider links that go this way and the opposite way. So to each L, consider also L minus 1, which is the same link but oriented the other way, just for being easier with notation, and associate to it the same group element as L, but the other way around, so minus 1. So this is the part that's brought from here to there. This is just to write equations easier. So this means that the quantum states are functions of big capital L group elements, SU2. That's what they are. The actual interesting space is a subspace of this, formed by those wave functions which are gauge invariant at the nodes, okay, and namely those which have the following property. For each link, if I make a gauge transformation here and there, the function remained the same, so this is equal to. So let me, for each node, introduce a gauge transformation parameter lambda n, which is in SU2 also. Like UL, these are in SU2. So this is the gauge transformation of the node, the change of frame at the node. And then the transformation of this is with one lambda on one side and one lambda, the other, lambda minus 1 on the other side. So U lambda lambda minus 1, where for each link, this is the node where it starts, which I call S of L, the source of L, and this is the node where it ends, which I call T of L, the target of L. So these are the states which are invariant under that. And the space of states that satisfy that, I call it L2, it's just notation, of SU2 to the L divided SU2 to the N because of one gauge transformation. Just to make sure that by that, I mean the quotient under that particular operation, sometimes I'll add a gamma there to be sure. Okay? So this is the interesting Hilbert space on which things happen, the SU2 gauge invariant one. So this probably better deserves the name of H gamma, the one determined by the graph. On this Hilbert space, I have I have defined the operators L. So these are what? These are the generators of SU2, so the left invariant vector field acting on the UL group element, and they have they multiplied by 8 pi g have the interpretation as the operator associated to the tetrad. The corresponding square CL Casimir L, which is L, so summed over the internal indices of the algebra, this is up to a constant, the operator that corresponds to the length. And since it is a Casimir, its eigenvalues are easy to find, and I call them JL, JL plus 1. This is the length squared, in fact. So this is where we were. And what we want to do now, before going to the actual transition amplitudes, is these are the eigenvalues of this operator, right? Eigenstates of this operator. So do the proper diagonalization of this operator. So look, what are the states in this Hilbert space that diagonalize these operators here and prove that these are a complete set of commuting observables, the sense of Dirac. So this is it. I mean, if we have a basis to diagonalize that, we don't need other quantum numbers. These quantum numbers are sufficient. The JL, a sufficient quantum number to characterize a complete set of states. That's what we want to show. So,
so before actually you do that, could you please repeat one more time? How did you assign to these E's when quantizing them, these operators L's? Why do you assign to E's SU2 operators? What is the logic behind that? Because U is the connection which belongs to SU2. So why E, when quantized, belongs to SU2?
Think about the Young-Mills theory. When you do Young-Mills theory on the lattice, the Hilbert space you have is exactly this Hilbert space here. And the electric field operator is exactly this thing here. In the canonical theory, you want to identify a configuration space and a phase space. And then your states are functions on a configuration space, and the momentum variables are the conjugate operators to that. So you could play this game in a number of ways. One possibility is maybe I can do that at the end of this class, this time. One possibility is to write the configuration space for the theory in a given triangulation explicitly. The configuration space turn out to be basically this space here, okay, SU2 to the L divided by this action of SU2 to the L. And so this gives the states. And the phase space is a cotangent bundle of that. So you can go to a proper quantization of this phase space, and you end up with the elements and the momentum elements quantized by those operators here. And then the question is, what are these momenta in the classical theory? You have to look at the action, and in the action you have to identify the momenta. Okay, so you have to identify what are the momenta operator corresponding to that. So you look at the canonical theory carefully, you look at the action, and you find out that the conjugate momentum, the connection is the tetrad, is the triad. So that's going to be the triad operator. Now, if you take a book like Tiemann's book, for instance, this is done line by line properly with all sorts of details. This can be done. In other words, there are many procedures for quantization in the literature, which can be followed step by step. But I would not overemphasize these procedures for quantization. Quantization is an inverse process. You really have to guess a quantum theory which has a classical limit. So in reality, these quantization procedures are just tricks for constructing a Hilbert space and a set of operators such that in the limit gives something that you want. So they're never completely univocal. They're never, they can always be played in many, in different ways. What matters is at the end of the day, we have a quantum structure, and we know it's a quantum structure, a Hilbert space operator, such that classically they describe what you want. That's why I sort of sidestepped the details of the construction in this presentation. So what we want is first show that this CL, the Casimir, are a complete set. And second, find the eigenvectors. So the states JL, the states which are diagonalize all these things here, find them explicitly. Find them explicitly in this representation here. Right? So what we want is we want psi JL of UL, or the representation of the state JL in the basis UL, okay, in Dirac notation. So in order to do that, let's put physics on a side for a moment and just remind you some basic mathematics of SU2, because that's all what you need, and introduce all the basic tools of SU2 that we need to do quantum gravity. This is a set of tools of SU2 that you need to do quantum gravity. So let's talk about math for a while. Math. Do physics here, and let me just remind you some very basic stuff about SU2 and build over that. So first of all, what is SU2? Well, SU2 is a set of 2x2 matrices, U. In the papers, they all sometimes call H, little h also is very much used. It's very much used when there's also SL2C around. So H is an SU2 matrix, G is an SL2C matrix. But for the moment, let me just use U. So U is a 4x4 complex matrix, which is unitary. U dagger equal U, and U minus 1 equal U, and is U to U dagger, here I am, and the determinant of U equal 1, which means that there are four complex numbers. A, B, those conditions tell me that this is A bar, this is minus B bar, and this says that A squared plus B squared, modulo squared, is equal 1. So you see, you have four real numbers, the real and imaginary part of each one, such that the square equal 1. So topologically, it's just a sphere of unique radius in R4, right? So it's S3. So topologically, this is S3. And since it's a sphere of unique radius in R4, you just take the measure in R4, the Euclidean measure in R4, you restrict it to the sphere, you get the symmetric measure on the sphere. So this means that there is a measure here, which is symmetric, and it's easy to see that it is, in fact, in the SU2 invariant measure, which I'm going to call du, simply, okay? Which has a property which is a Haar measure, so it's invariant right left. So in other words, du is the same as duv for every v on both sides, okay? So this is the Haar measure. On SU2, which is like all our measure, defined by what I said up to normalization, which is chosen to be one on the entire group. So we know there is a measure on this thing here, and it has an algebra, like all Lie groups, is a corresponding Lie algebra, which is written in small letters, the algebra, which is traceless matrices and blah, 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 blah. So a basis in the algebra, in this algebra in SU2, is given by the three matrices. Let me just put the minus, the I precise of what the way I'm going to use it. Three matrices tau I defined to be minus I half sigma I. That's a where sigma I is 1 to 3 are the Pauli matrices, right? So 1, 1, minus 1, 1, minus I, and 1, minus 1. It's the one which... one's a mission, the other are anti-missions, and that's why there's this shift notation. So every element of SU2 can be written in the form e to the alpha I tau I, the exponentiation of a matrix in the algebra, and I've written a formula for that in terms of expansion, in terms of the three sigma themselves and the identity. Now, what we need, what we're going to need, and what we need to solve that problem there is basically the Fourier transform on the group, essentially, which is provided by the representation theory of SU2, for the unitary representation theory of SU2. So the representation theory is well known. So what is a representation theory? It's a problem of finding matrices D, depending on U, so a map from the group itself to a group of matrices, such that DUV is equal to DUDV, right? So in that sense is a representation, acting on some space, H, which has a scalar product and such that these matrices are unitary. That's why it's unitary representation theory. Why do we want unitary representation? Because this is quantum mechanics. So we want symmetries to be represented by unitary operators in the... And of course, the generators of this are going to be the generators, operators, which are generators of symmetries, like you know from quantum mechanics very well. Now, the representation of theory of SU2 is well studied in all the book. Angular momentum is used for doing atomic physics, nuclear physics, molecular physics, normally studied. There are books and books on that with all possible formulas you can imagine. And it's very simple. They are the irreducible representation. So every representation can be written as a sum of irreducible. The irreducible representation are labeled by a spin, J, which is a half integer, etc. And so there is a one HJ for each J, whose dimension, the dimension, is 2j plus 1, which will come all over, so we better give it a name. We call it dj. So we don't have to write dj plus 1 over and over again. And the actual, so in this hj, we can choose a basis. Often one chooses a basis that analyzes the third rotation z in the three directions, basis m. So M goes from minus j plus 1 all the way to j, and the matrices are called D, j, sometimes the parenthesis M, n, of U are called Wigner matrices. And are written, their actual form, it's written explicitly in books and things. And if you have Mathematica, I think you type Wigner matrices to give you the matrix element explicitly. Now, the key property that these Wigner matrices F, with respect to this measure here, is the following, which it's the basis of everything. So I'm going to illustrate it a little bit. If you integrate in the Haar measure d j prime m prime n prime of u against d j m n of u, put a bar here, then this is zero unless j equal j prime, m equal a prime, n equal n prime. And if they're equal, it's just one of dj, delta j, j prime, so yeah. Delta m, m prime, yeah. Delta n, n prime. Which means that these objects here form a basis and an orthogonal basis. In fact, up to this dj here, if you multiply by square root of j, even on the normal basis, in the Hilbert space of functions over SU2 with that measure there. Right? So this forms an orthogonal basis in this Hilbert space there. In other words, in this Hilbert space, you can write a basis JMN. which is defined in the following way. Okay? And this basis here is orthogonal. So this is equal j prime, m prime, n prime, j, m, n. Now, this formula here is the content. It's not infinitely straightforward to demonstrate. It takes a while. In fact, there's a name attached to it. It's a theorem. It's called the Peter Weyl theorem. Peter Weyl theorem is that formula there. But let me give you a different way of thinking about that. If SU2 has a basis like that, it means that I can decompose the space here in that basis. So it means that L2, so there's another way of expressing this, the same thing. L2 of SU2 can be thought as a sum over J. Okay? But now careful. The range of M and the range of N depend on J, of course, right? So a sum of J of what? Of matrices. But a matrix is a map from Hj to Hj. And a map from Hj to Hj is an element of Hj tensor Hj dual. Right? So I can think that the structure of this space here is sum of J of this Hilbert space Hj, which carry the representation tensor Hj dual. In fact, dual, I can write it or not write it. since this is an Hilbert space, the dual, finite dimension Hilbert space, the dual is the same thing as itself. It was dual only in the sense that it transforms under the dual representation. So it's basically, it's as a linear space, and as a Hilbert space, is the same object. So this is the structure of, this is another way of writing the Peter Weyl theorem. Now, it's good if you. How many of you knew this formula before? One only. So let me give you a way of thinking about that formula, since you didn't know it, because things become simple when they are familiar. Think about a group that you know very well, U1, and let's do exactly the same thing. U1 is what? U1 is the rotation. Okay. So an element of this group is an angle, alpha, which goes between 0 and 2 pi. Okay, which is a group under sum. It's a group when you sum two angles up to modulo 2 pi, it's a group, obviously. So what are the representations of this group? What are the d of alpha such that d of alpha plus beta, because this is the sum in the group, is d of alpha times d of beta? Well, you know all these things there. right? These are the these are all one-dimensional. So the dimension of each representation, they are labeled by n, the analog of the spin for, and they are just given by, as soon as I write it, you recognize, you see immediately what it is, I n alpha, which obviously I n alpha times I n beta is equal I n alpha plus beta. So it's a representation. Okay? So it's the representation. So for U1, a label by an n. I have no indices here, given by that. And what is the scalar product of this? Well, the R measure, of course, is the alpha, 2 pi, because I want it normalized, because I want it the integral of the group equal 1. So this is the R measure. And if I write d alpha, dn of alpha bar dm of alpha, okay, this is going to give what? It's going to give the integral of e to the minus n alpha times e to the I n alpha from 0 to 2 pi, which of course is delta n m. So it's 1 if it's the same representation. So the matrix element of the representation, of the unitary representation, form a basis in the Hilbert space L2 of U1, which is nothing else than L2 of S1 d alpha circle, square root of all functions of the surface. And that's the same thing. It's the same thing, except that instead of a circle on this ball, this three ball, which is SU2, okay? Same symmetry. So these are the the eigenstates, these are the Fourier modes in on SU2, essentially. Right? We're doing harmonic analysis on SU2. Now we have everything, because we just can take this formula and apply it to our Hilbert space there. And I'll do it in two ways. First, in a little bit in an abstract way, and then a little bit more concrete way. Let me do it first in an abstract way. So now we want L2 of SU2 to the L, to the power L. Okay, let's apply this formula here. So then we have, so these are functions of L elements. So this Hilbert space is the tensor product over the links of one of these Hilbert spaces for each link, right? So of the sum over J, HJ tensor HJ. Okay. But the product of the sum is a sum of products, of course. Okay. This is this summed over times this summed over times this summed over. So I have all the, so I can rewrite this as a sum over what? Over, so for L equal 1, I have J1, for L equal 2, I have J2, for L equal 3, I have J3. So over some JL, of for each assignment of one of the L, I have just these things here. So I have the product over all L of HJL tensor HJL. Let's go back to the graph. For each L, for each link of the graph, all these links, I have a spin assigned to it, JL. And for each given spin, for each element of the graph, I have two Hilbert spaces. which let me usefully thinks one sitting here and one sitting here. These are in the representation given by this spin here. Why I put one put here, one put here? Because when I do a gauge transformation there, I act on one side and the other side of the U. So the gauge transformation here act here, the gauge transformation here act here. So I put it, it's H next to the space where it transformed. Okay? So it turns out that next to this space, there would be one Hilbert space in the representation coming from that, one coming from that, and one coming from that. So I can rearrange this structure here as sum over JL. And then the tensor product of all these. So the product over all nodes instead of links, OK? Instead of grouping per link, I group it for per nodes. The tensor product on all the nodes of what? On the nodes, I have H, J, let me call it J1, J2, J3. Where J1, J2, J3 are the spins of the three links that come out from this node. Okay? Now, this is L2 of SUB to the L. Why have I written things that way? Because what I'm interested in is not this space, but the space of gauge invariant state, H gamma. H gamma is going to be the subspace of this space, which is invariant under the action of SU2 here on each node. But how does it act, SU2? Well, it acts on this Hilbert space and this Hilbert space and this Hilbert space. So each one of these lambda, which sits on the node, transforms this representation, this representation, this representation. So for each node, it transforms these three. So what is going to be what is going L2 of SU2 to the L divided SU2 to the N B? Well, it's going to be the same thing. Sum over JL tensor N. And then not this, but the invariant part of it. The SU2 invariant part of that. So the invariant part under the common SU2, this is the SU2 that acts on the node, of that three things there, HJ1, tensor HJ2, tensor HJ3. So let's study this object. Well, back to math. Just go back to your angular momentum theory, and you remember that if you have two representations, J1 tensor J2, right? This is an angular momentum combination. The common thing can be diagonalized with respect to L squared and can be written as a sum of irreducible of HJ, where J goes from the difference of that, J1 minus J2, to the sum of that, J1 plus J2. Do you remember from elementary quantum mechanics? Is that fine? So what about three of them? H1 tensor J2 tensor J3 is going to be this. So the sum J going from J1 minus J2 to J1 plus J2 of HJ, tensor HJ3. But this again, it's going to be a sum of this and this is going to give a sum, again, on some k, where k goes from j minus j3 to j plus j3, okay? And then in front of it, I have, j is given by that, of some hk. Now, what if I want the invariant part of that? Well, the invariant part of that is a thing that transforms in the representation of spin equals zero. That's by definition invariant. It does not transform. Okay? Spin representation zero is just one number, and each matrix each bigger matrix is one, so it doesn't transform. So I want this k to be equal to zero. Okay, it can be equal to zero only if j is equal to j3. Right. And if j equal j3, it means that k is included in these numbers here. So it means that j3 is equal to k. So j3 is equal to j. So it's included between this and that. So j3 must be larger than j1 minus j2 and smaller than j1 plus j2. Okay. If this condition is satisfied, then there is one and only one invariant. There's one and only one spin zero factor here. So in that case, this is just, so if that condition is satisfied, this is called triangular inequality or Mandelstam identity, one of the Mandelstam identities called triangular inequality. So if the triangular inequalities are satisfied, this is just the spin zero representation, so it's just C. If it's not satisfied, then there's no invariant part. Remember what this spin R in quantum gravity. This spin R, the eigenvalue is the length of triangles. Okay, so this exists. This invariant part exists only if you have a triangle. You have J1, J2, J3 here. Only if the length of that happens to be longer than the difference of these two and smaller than the sum of these two. But this is exactly the condition for triangle to exist in geometry, right? So the representation theory knows that the invariant part of this describes triangles if the length are identified with the spin, if the spins are identified with the length. That's why it's called triangular inequalities, right? So if the sum of the two is smaller than that, there's no triangle. And if the and so on for this. So these are the inequality that are the necessary and sufficient conditions for three numbers, J1, J2, J3, to be lengths of a triangle. Good. So the space here is just a sum over one-dimensional things. So that means that there are no other quantum numbers at the JL. But the JL are the eigenstates of the Casimir. So this proves that the Casimirs are a complete set, nothing else. Okay? And that's point one is proven. Now, what are the objects? If I have a representation, if I have a representation hj, the object sitting here is some vector with an index n, right? Where m goes from minus j to j. So if I have a tensor of, if I have a tensor hj1, tensor hj2, tensor hj3, the object here are objects with three indices, m1, m2, m3. And if this is a component of the invariant part of that, it means that this is invariant under the action of SU2 on each one of these indices. If I transform each one of them. So what I've just shown is that up to normalization, up to multiplication by number, there is only one quantity, Vm1, M2, M3, which is invariant under SU2. OK? It's only one. This quantity has a name. It's called 3j. So the invariant object is sometimes called I, m1, m2, m3. Let me use some notation. And is often written as following way, m1, m2, m3, j1, j2, j3. And it's called the Wigner 3j, the 3j symbol. And it's uniquely defined up to the normalization. We'll fix the normalization in a moment. And it's a key object in what follows. Okay? It's the Wigner 3J symbol. And if you put it in Mathematica, it just splits up the number. It exists only if J1, J2, and J3 satisfy the triangular inequalities. Otherwise, it doesn't exist. Okay? It's only defined in those cases there.
We want this. Conditions to be for all permutations.
Each one implies the other. Yes, we want it for all permutations, but they, if you check, they imply one another. And if you think about the triangle, it's immediate. If you have two lengths and a third one, which are shorter than the sum and longer than the difference, then you can make a triangle, and therefore each one of the other one is shorter than the sum and longer than the difference. So this is really algebra and geometry that talk about. So the answer is yes, we want it for each combination, but they are satisfied if they're satisfied just for one permutation. Okay, good. So if this was a little bit too abstract, let me redo it in a much more concrete way. It's going to be, of course, slightly more heavy. So let me write the state psi u, ul. So this is the state in this larger Hilbert space on the basis of the the Wigner matrices. So in other words, if I have just one group element here, any state like that can be written as a sum over j, m and n of some c, j, m, and n, dj, m, n, u. Right? This is Hilbert, basic Hilbert space theory. If you have a basis, you can write any element as a linear combination of the basis element. So if I have a function of l, 1 to l things, then I have to sum over j1, jl, m1, ml, n1, nl, the coefficients that will depend on all this, jl, m1, nl, n1, nl, and then dj1, m1, n1, u1, djl, ml, nl, ul. Okay? These things here, if you want, show all the structure here, right? We are summing over all JL, and then we have ML and NL as indices, which are the indices here and here. So it's exactly the structure here. And this is structure here depend on the fact that the range of M and the range of N depend on J. So if I want to write abstractly, I have to do it that way. Now, if I want a state which is invariant under the action of SU2 on the nodes, Then it must be invariant if I, on the node here, I put a lambda, so it's going to act on some u, on just three of these u's. And let me say for simplicity that these are oriented outside. Otherwise, it's going to be a little bit more complicated, but it's going to be the same thing. So let me say they're oriented outside. So this is to be equal the same if I put a lambda just on those three, ABC, are the links which come out from the node. So just take three of these, and I put a lambda here, nothing should change. But this is a representation, so that means that I'm going to find with d lambda acting on the indices, on three of these indices. Let me call them MA, MB, MC, MA, MB, MC prime, acting on this one. So this should do nothing if I insert this. Which means that if I multiply this thing here by a matrix, if I transform three of these indices, nothing happens. But the only possibility for something for three indices for nothing to happen is that it is one of these objects here, times something with the other indices. So at the end of the day, okay, this necessarily, if this is invariant, has the form sum over J1, JL. Okay, some coefficients that just depend on J1, JL, and then those intertwiners here, M, A, M, B, M, C, and a long list of these intertwiners, one for each node, M, E, M, F, M, G, times all these matrices here, D, U, where let me put the indices upstairs, sorry. M A, M B, M C, M E, M F, M G, where those indices here are contracted with all those indices here, and you see things match because there's one of these per each, there's one D per each link, and there's one I per each node. And the way the indices are contracted is determined by the graph. So each I here has three indices, MA, MB, MC. Each D has two indices, N and N, of U. And you want to contract these and this to reproduce the graph. Right? All this thing here is uniquely determined by the graph, by the structure of the graph. But this is the object we're looking for. That's the psi JL of UL. So do you see down here? No, you don't see down here. So I have to go. What else? Over here. So finally, a generic state is the sum over JL. Let me just write it this way. C J1 JL, just let me write JL, and some psi JL of U, is exactly what they wanted, where psi JL of U, it's equal what? It's the product of all the nodes of the intertwiner associated to the node, the product of all the links of the Wigner matrices of UL, okay, in the representation JL, contracted with all the indices of these, contracted with all the indices. So they are contracted how? Reproducing the structure of a graph. This object here is called a spin network state. And if you want, you can rewrite it as UL JL. Or if you want, the Spinetto straight is the abstract state JL. It's a representation in the basic element of the group is that one. So Spinetto states are an eigenbasis of the length operator. They span the gauge invariant Hilbert space, and they have a simple geometric interpretation. They just say how long are this, the links of this thing here, how long are the links of the triangulation. And they're definitely different than the classical triangulations because the length of the link is discrete, not continuous. Of course, a generic quantum state is a linear superposition of that. So you can take arbitrary linear, this is quantum mechanics, you can take arbitrary linear combinations of this and
a question?
Yes.
So you said the spin network state is JL, which is what in this expression? Because, I mean, that the psi JL UL, and that's the bracket UL JL. So what was the spin network state in this?
If I give you an Hilbert space in some representation, function of x, think of a particle. So the Hilbert space is L2 of R. So the states are just psi of x, okay? And then you say, okay, let me define momentum states. What is a momentum state? Well, this is the state in the representation x. If I want a momentum state in the representation x, I have to give this quantity here. If I have to give this quantity here, I define the state, the momentum state. So if I say, for instance, this is IPX, I've defined this object here. I define it by a linear combination. So if you want to write me abstractly, JL is, just go the other way around, right? Sum over UL, or the integral of UL. This is a discrete basis, this is not a continuous basis of the UL JL UL. Okay. This is a generalized basis like this one, the X and P. This is a discrete basis. So the better analogy is L2 of S1, okay, the alpha. So here, psi of alpha, and then P is defined by P alpha is E to the N alpha, where now is N, is this is discrete, and this is continuous. So that's the same thing. Here, the J is a discrete thing. We have a Hilbert space, we have a configuration space, which is a SU2, is compact. So when you go to the Fourier modes, these are discrete. So the lengths are discrete. The group elements are continuous. Okay. Good. I was hoping to do also the transition amplitudes today, but of course, time flies. So next time we really go to the transition amplitudes. Stop here. I'll just take 1 second. No. So, in four dimensions, it will be the same, with a little bit of technical complication added. And the technical complication is that in four dimensions, we will not have triangles, we will have tetrahedra. Okay? So this will be exactly like here. Nothing will change, except that we will have not three, but four of these Hilbert spaces. And since we have four of the Hilbert spaces, this argument here that there's only one possible tetrahedron will not go through. There will be several possible determiners, okay? But not many. In fact, this with four things is a finite dimensional hyperspace. Its invariant part is a finite dimensional hyperspace. So the space of the intertwiners, instead of having just one possible intertwiners, is a finite dimensional space of intertwiners. Okay? So it will not be true that the Casimir is sufficient as quantum numbers, form a complete basis. We'll need something else. We need something that chooses which intertwiner is there. So we need one other quantum number. Okay? And in four dimension, what here is the length, the Casimir is the length. In four dimension, you have already seen it. The Casimir is going to be the area of the surface of the triangle. So we'll need another quantum number. Just take the volume, which chooses which intertwiner is it. That's exactly the calculation we've done the first day. So in four dimension, the basis, there will be a spin network basis. All things will go through, except that here we'll have to sum not only on the J, but also on which intertwiner we have chosen in each node. So in four dimensions, the basis will be given in 4D. The basis will be given by JL and which intertwiner on each node, and we'll choose the one which has a certain volume. So it'll be given by the area and the volume. Okay? This determines the spin, and this determines the particular intertwiner that we put there. And we choose the intertwiner that analyzes the volume. The little calculation that we did the first day is a calculation that in the Hilbert space, which is the invariant part of four representation of SU2, diagonalizes an operator, which is well-defined in this thing here, which is going to be the volume. So you will see, once you have digested that, doing the four-dimensional thing was going to be very easy. Just a little technical configuration in addition. And the states will be given by two quantum numbers, area and volume.
Do you do four-dimensional also Euclidean? Is also Euclidean in four dimensions?
The difference, it's, the four-dimensional theory will do the Lorentzian one. The difference will be, this important difference will be in the transition amplitudes. That's where you see that is Lorentzian and Euclidean. In four dimensions, this is all a fixed time, right? This is, so you don't know whether time is Euclidean or Lorentzian. So that's why it would be almost the same thing, just one dimension up. So tomorrow, I'll use again SU2 representation theory, and in fact, I'll use another formula, the one in which you integrate not just two big elements, but three elements, and I'll show that once you have this basis, writing the transition amplitudes, it's gonna be easy, and there will be a spectacularly simple formula for the transition amplitude. I will write it this way. And the formula will arrive is a very famous formula found by Regge in the 60s, which at the time amazed everybody for quantum gravity, Euclidean quantum gravity in three dimensions. At the time, everybody was hoping, okay, we just have to do the same in four dimensions, and we have quantum gravity. It took, in fact, 50 years more to do the same in four dimensions. So tomorrow, it's a transition amplitude and the Pisano-Regge formula. Stop here.